thing on? Is it working? All right. Howard says yes, so it must be that way. Anyway, my name is Jim Noyes, and I'm the Executive Director of the Institute, and I want to welcome everybody to Day 2. I will spend a few moments here going over what we're going to be talking about today. Did everybody enjoy yesterday? Did that fit the bill for the most part? Okay. And what great timing, because if you didn't hear, as of right now, California does have a slimmed-down bond that we will be voting on in November. I'm not quite sure if anything fell out of it. My first understanding is that it's a slimmed-down version from $11 billion to $7.5 billion. I understand that there are some pots of money that may not be in there anymore, but I'm not quite sure of that. If anybody has any more information on that, feel free to stand up and let us know. Along those lines, and again, one of my straw man votes, based on what you know right now, those of you in California, would you be inclined to vote yes on this bond? Show of hands. Would you be inclined to vote no? There are some no's, but the yeas, by observation, are greater than the no's. Anyway, I want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our exhibitors today. And I haven't had enough time yet to really go through the exhibitors carefully, but what I have, I've enjoyed what I see. So I want to thank them, and if you get a chance, please stop by and chat with some of the exhibitors. I forgot this yesterday. One other commercial note: Michael Anderson was here yesterday, the state climatologist, and when I saw a couple of months ago that we were going to have the state climatologist speaking yesterday, I said to myself, I did not know we had a state climatologist. And then I remember, oh yeah, that's right, I remember. I made a comment to somebody and they reminded me, yes, we have a climatologist, and that triggered it, I remember. Anyway, I had an email from him, which I was going to ask him to address yesterday. NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is trying to go out and get information from their clients, their customers, as to the services they provide. So if you're interested in that, check the NOAA website or check with Michael Anderson. They're having an event August 25 and 26 in Sacramento. So they'll be available, and if you're interested, you can take advantage of that. I'm not sure what we heard yesterday about El Nino. I mean, everybody seemed to come out of it based on what I overheard yesterday evening and so forth. What did we hear? Well, we probably heard what we all kind of thought we were going to hear, and as a climatologist pointed out, there have been 25 El Ninos since 1950. Half of them, we got more rain. Half of them, we got average rainfall or a little bit under that. So there you have it. What does it mean? I know I used to work for LA County Flood Control District, and several years ago, I asked our hydrology people to run a check, and that's pretty much what they came up with. At least our experiences, our rain gauges, half the time, it was just a nothing. The other half, it was wetter. Sometimes, just a little bit wetter. A few times, 97, 98, very wetter. So, what does it mean? I think it only means that we have a lot to learn about El Nino and what may or may not happen from an El Nino. If there was an encouraging part of it, at least Dr. Pierce did say that there's a 75% chance that there will be an El Nino. So, we have a chance, anyway, of getting relieved by the cavalry. We call it El Nino, as you see in the program, the cavalry. Tomorrow, we are having all of the program, other than Congressman Garamendi. We decided, well, if we're going to have somebody talk about, are we going to be saved by the cavalry? What if the cavalry don't show up? What then? So tomorrow, we have four speakers, two regional water reps, a speaker from the Bureau, and a speaker from the state of California, and they're going to share with us what if we're in the same mess next spring, that we didn't get relief, no El Nino, we're still dry, or maybe drier. What are you going to do? What are they going to do? What are we all going to do? Now, we understand that they can't really speculate what they're going to be doing a year from now, but they can give us some good ideas and some good thoughts. So that's the point of what we're doing tomorrow. So if you have nothing better to do tonight, you can think about what kind of questions you want to ask them. Dr. Blanco yesterday indicated that the Southwest is going to get drier, and it may get very much drier. She didn't really get into that. She's on this team, the National Climate Assessment. In May, they came out with their third annual report, and like she said, for the first time, they zeroed in on various parts of the country, and she was involved in doing the analysis for the Southwest. I've skimmed through that assessment on the internet, and it seems to be, it's very well done, it strikes me. And there's, you know, it's got to be print form, it's got to be that thick. This is the third one they did. This assessment effort started, I think, in the late 80s. And it points out, and again, she didn't get into it that much, but it does get a little bit into it, the impact of drought that we as water managers might not think of. There are sessions in there, there's the discussion about the health effects. Health effects, what does it mean if we have a drought in terms of public health and so forth? Anyway, interesting. Well, when you think of the Southwest, you think of the Colorado River. And for those of you that have been to our August conference, you'll remember that we always have something to say about the Colorado River. Today is Colorado River Day. You may be aware that in December of 2012, the Bureau, in fulfillment of some federal legislation, introduced their future supply demand study for the Colorado River. 2 years ago, which was 4 months before that came out, we had Carly Jurla speak to us. Carly is, I call her the lead author of that report. I don't know if that's accurate or not, so I'll say it anyway. She came to us and she told us what she could about what was in the report. And folks commented on that. Last year, the report had been out. Not a lot had been done with it up to that point in time. But we had others comment on their aspects of it. This year, they've gone many steps further in terms of organizing efforts to take a look at that study and kind of lay the groundwork for what the basin states and all of the Colorado River water holders and caretakers are need to be addressed. So we will hear that all day today, and I'll get into a little bit more of that as we go on. Carly will be our second speaker. They have established three work groups. We will hear from all three of those work groups. We will hear from John Ainsmayer. John is the new general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. He's been on the job, I think, since February or March. He'll give us his perspective on Southern Nevada and where they are going. We've invited the tribes, the Colorado River tribes, to come back and share with us their thinking on that. And we also have a presentation from the Sonoran Institute, which I believe is based in Tucson. And they're going to tell us what their thoughts are. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be a good day. And as always, we'll have our program and questions and answers. And don't be bashful about stepping in there and asking your questions. To lead us off now at 9:15, we have Terry Falk, Dr. Terry Falk. He is the regional director for the Lower Colorado region in Boulder City, Nevada. I think this is his third time for visiting with us. As you walk in the door, you'll notice we have, I think it's the August 1st version of the drought index map for the western U.S. And it's kind of coincidental that everywhere there's drought kind of overlaps the boundaries of the Bureau of Reclamation. So we've asked Terry to address what's going on. What is the Bureau up to? What are they doing as well as anything else appropriate for our audience. So, Terry, you're here, I know, there you are. Please welcome Terry Falk.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here again. As Jim said, we were standing outside for a brief moment, and I was trying to remember with Jim how long it'd been since I've been here. I don't know that either of us remembered it, but I think what I concluded was, if my ticket back means the drought has to continue, I'm not planning to punch it. So we'll see if that's how it turns out. It is a pleasure to be here. I want to just make a couple of preliminary remarks about what my topics will be today. First of all, my focus is the Colorado River Basin. And as Jim said, the drought extends throughout the 17 western United States, which is the Bureau of Reclamation's domain. But I won't touch on what others are doing in our agency. I know tomorrow you're going to hear from our Mid-Pacific region in one of the panels, and they'll covering the Northern California situation from our perspective. I want to also just say a couple things about my title. You'll see I changed the title a little bit there. And what I really want to talk to you about is how this basin has responded to a variety of conditions, including this severe drought, over the last 15 or so years. I think that sets a good perspective for what we're currently working on and what we're planning to do. With that also said, you'll see I dropped the title Bureau even for our Colorado River focused discussion. And the reason I did that was it's really by broad participation of all our partners and stakeholders that we come up with these collaborative solutions that I'm going to talk to you about. We couldn't do it alone. We would absolutely be guaranteed to not find solutions that, number one, make sense to everyone, and number two, are implementable. I think we would likely end up in court, and we don't really like that. We think it's much better to operate in a proactive, collaborative sense and avoid litigation as much as we possibly can. I could probably best sum this up with this phrase, and you've all heard it. Truly, on the Colorado River Basin, we're all in it together. And that's the way it has worked. It's the way I think it must continue to work. Now, that's not it's easy to say, very hard to implement. Everyone has different perspectives. Everyone is absolutely charged with protecting their water rights. Yet, everyone has been able to come together and see the other person's position. And in doing so, appreciate that. And finally, finding these kinds of collaborative solutions. So our success, I believe, in dealing with this prolonged drought will be highly dependent upon that continuing that approach. So I'm going to take us back a little bit in time over the last 15 years, because I think sometimes knowing where we've been and how we dealt with it sets us up really nicely for dealing with the current situations. And there we go. So everyone, I bet you in this room, has seen this slide. And what this is on the vertical axis is flow in millions of acre feet. And on the horizontal axis is essentially the last 105 years. It's the extent of our historical gauged record. And the bars represent the annual natural flow into the Point Lees Ferry. And Lees Ferry, as most of you know, is right below Glen Canyon Dam and very close to the what is often termed the compact point between the upper and lower basins. And so there's just a couple of things to get glean for sure on this plot. And one is obviously the high variability. We all know that. The other one is this average line is the green, it looks to me like, I hope it does to you, line. That's just the running average. It's been sloping down since the 20s, and we all know that. We've seen that in writing many times, that the compact was negotiated, put together in a period of high flows, and certainly those folks did a masterful job in getting there with a very limited view of what the system might produce over time. I think the other thing I want to point out to you, and I'll try to see if I can point it on the pointer, hopefully you can see that, is if we go back just in the late 90s, notice that period of high flows in the 90s. And quite frankly, with our large amount of storage capacity, and you probably have all heard this number, we can store over 4 times the average annual inflow into the system. That's a very unique system compared to most water management systems. And so we've absolutely saw this over time, built this large amount of infrastructure to do just that, collect up those high flow years and dole them out on the low flow years, because you'll also look throughout that record and you'll see periods of low flows. And we are clearly in one now, and I'm going to focus this on this last 15 years here. Okay, so just blow that up. Now I'm going to not bore you with hydrology. This plot is slightly different because it's called unregulated flow, but we'll set that aside, please. It's not germane to our conversation right at the point. It's very analogous, and I think it tells exactly the story. So now the plot is 1999 to 2014, and the flow again is in millions of acre feet. So what you have is the dark bars are the combined storage of Lake Powell and Lake Mead. So as many of you know, Lake Powell and Lake Mead together comprise about 83% of that total 60 million acre foot storage capacity. So looking at those two lakes gives us a great indication of where the system is. The other thing that's very important to understand, which I'm guessing most of you do, Lake Powell sets just above the compact line that separates the upper and lower basins, and Lake Mead, of course, sets just below it. So again, they carry great importance in terms of our water management strategies on the system. So that combined storage in 1999, as we had seen in the past, and now I don't see the, I think it just doesn't show up on that color, maybe. In any event, over on the left, if you see, we were nearly full. We were almost 95% full in these two big lakes. And over that first 5 years, we dropped dramatically. And that's shown by the line as well as the bar graph. And then underneath is a light blue bar graph, and you'll see these are the inflows each year that as a percent of average. So that being said, watch how quickly the storage dropped the first 5 years. Then we kind of have been bouncing around half full. Notice I always use half full, not half empty. And we've been continually doing that, although now we've dipped back down below less than half full. Notice the 2011, and if I have to, I'll walk. There we go. It woke up, or maybe I wasn't pushing it good. Notice in 2011, we had 139% of average. And wow, that was a great year. And we'd love to have several of those. And quite frankly, when that occurred, I personally was extremely optimistic that we might not have 3 or 4 of those in a row. It might not be 83, 84, and 85 repeated. But certainly, I did not expect to follow it with consecutively one of the two worst periods we've ever seen in the historic record. So again, what that points out is just the variability on this system and how difficult it is to project the future. So what I want to do is to also hone in on just this year for just a moment to catch up. I won't spend much time, and then we'll come back to this slide. Oh. There we go. So snowpack this year was above average. Actually, that's the median in the middle plotted, and then the top graph is the snowpack. It peaked in April, early April, 111% of average, and we all know it's really the snow that drives the system here. So it was a reasonable snowpack year. Precip for the whole water year is about 99% of average. Gosh, I'll have to watch my hard thumb there, but here's the way it got distributed in the upper basin. So this is the main Colorado River Storage Project reservoirs in the upper basin, and the little diagrams on the left in the map, we call them teacup diagrams, and they show how full those reservoirs are. So clearly, up in the green part of the basin, we had a great year. Compare that down here to the bottom in the San Juan part of the basin, and we've 67% in terms of storage. And if you go over here, the reason is we only had 58% of inflow, of average inflow. So again, banner year on the green, okay, even pretty good in the heart of the Colorado, but pretty poor in the lower part of the basin. And that's pretty typical. Even though we average everything and say what average annual inflow or precip and inflow is, typically it's not distributed very well, evenly, I'll say it that way. And probably most of you have heard this little anecdotal statistic that nearly 85% of the runoff can be generated from 15% of the watershed. So again, it just shows how difficult it is for us to project in the future. So here's where we are today. And I point out a couple things. Compare the total system storage, 51%, to where it was last year, 50% at this time. So we're hanging around in the total system storage of about half full. But now notice Powell and Meade. So Powell, because it was a reasonably good year, is about half full. Meade's now down to 38%. So they're starting to get out of balance, and I'll explain here in just a second how the interim guidelines we put in place will attempt to bring them back into balance. All right, so that's where we are today. There we go. I'm going to show this graph only for one other reason, and that is the newspapers have glommed on very tightly to this idea that we once again crossed below a threshold that we had not seen at Lake Mead here in the last couple, 3 weeks. And that was since Lake Mead filled, which is on the far left of the graph. So this is the elevation of Lake Mead since the day we closed the dams, plotted annually. If you track over where we are, you see that, yes, this is as low as it's been. This is the period through the 50s when we were filling Powell, this one is, and this is the drought prior to that in the early 50s. So this again is 60s, sorry, and this is the 50s. So here we are, and each day we set a new low record. And we'll get down to about 1080 on Lake Mead, and then we'll climb back up a couple, 3 feet, which is normal for the end of the year just by the way the operation works. So it is what it is. All right, one last slide here, and that's a water budget at Lake Mead. So when I came up with this slide some more than 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly when it was, what I was trying to really look at is just simply if we just took our checkbook type approach, what's the water budget at Lake Mead? And what we're saying there is the inflow into Mead is primarily Powell's release, plus some side inflows. We deliver about $9 million out to meet the lower basin states to apportionments plus Mexico, plus we have system losses, so we release about 9.6, it varies each year. We can lose as much as 600,000, really more than 600,000 acre feet at Lake Mead due to evaporative losses, so if you add all that up, we get a negative when Powell's releasing what used to be, we call it kind of its normal release of 8.23 million acre feet. So how did this work? Well, it worked because, again, we'd collect up the high flow years and store them and build Mead back up, and then we could dole out it out during the lower flow years. And that works fine. It works fine as long as you get the high flow years. And we've said this more than once in many of these kinds of discussions. We here in the lower basin, we absolutely live on the high flow years. And that's the reason, because of that simple arithmetic. It makes it very clear to us that we have to get high flow years or Lake Mead continues to decline, which is what we've seen happen, as you saw in the last graph, over the last 15 to 20 years, since 1999 at least. Okay, so let me go back to that slide that I had walked you through before. About kind of the last 15 years. And what I want to do here is just hit on some highlights of the issues we've dealt with, the responses that we've made, including to this drought, and then where we are today as the drought continues. So I'm going to start over on the left again, and I want to ask you to remember those high-flow years in the late 90s from that first graph. So we walked into this period of 15 years with our two big lakes almost full. That's very fortunate. Obviously not guaranteed to do that all the time when you are coming up on a 15-year drought that you don't know about, but in any event, that's what we had. And one of the things we were working on at that time were surplus guidelines. So we had lots of water. And here in Lower Basin, basin-wide, we agreed to some interim surplus guidelines, as we called them, to take us through 2016. So let me just digress a minute and explain why we do interim measures. I think it's for two reasons. One is we all know we can't project the future very well. And so rather than lock ourselves in for too long a period of time, interim makes some sense. We can gain valuable operational experience. We see what works, what doesn't work, and then we can move on with more knowledge to the next agreement, so to speak. I think the other thing is these are very complex agreements. All of the pieces to come together to get to these agreements take lots of collaboration, lots of work from lots of people, and they become very complex. And the longer they extend in time and the broader they are in scope, the more difficult they are to put in place. And so we typically don't go too long in time, and sometimes we have to decrease our scope in order to take a step in the right direction. And so we continue to do that. So 1999, when surplus and the drought is upon us, but we don't quite realize that. But I don't think we messed that up by any event or by any stretch of the imagination. We put some triggers on Mean, and we said if Mean's got water above those, we think we've got enough water to release more water in the lower division states. And I think what it turned out to be is Mother Nature had a different idea, excuse me, and Mean fell, went below the triggers, and we haven't had surplus. All right, so as we move on in that little diagram, I'm going to just, I'm just going to keep that picture of time in mind, and I'll walk you through some of these key things. So one of the reasons surplus was so important was California was working on their California Water Use Plan, sometimes nicknamed the 4-4 plan, but the idea was, since California had been legally able to use Arizona's unused apportionment for a number of years, how would California wean themselves down, so to speak, as Arizona came up to full use? And so that's the idea behind that plan and the quantification settlement agreement and the federal agreement called the Colorado River Water Delivery Agreement. So all of that is one and the same. And the idea that that tied with the surplus is for that 15-year period, interim period, through 2016, California could get surplus. As long as the hydrology cooperated, there'd be a, quote, what was called a soft landing in order to get allow all of these transfers that are on that screen depicted with arrows to get ginned up, geared up, and occur. And, of course, that's not what happened. As we often say, it was a very hard landing, and we commend California, all of you, for meeting that obligation and getting to 4-4 that quickly. Those surplus guidelines are still in place, not exactly the way they were originally put in place, but they're part of the interim guidelines, and I'll talk about that. But one of the other things that we really realized was that we had to deal with endangered species on this river. And so we couldn't just ignore it. We were actually fortunate that it didn't hit our basin maybe as fast as it hit in other places. But it was very important to us. And so, again, back in the mid-90s even, this was ginned up perhaps on a cocktail napkin. I wasn't there, but I think that's pretty close to the way the idea got put together, was let's have a proactive, collaborative, cost-share program where we get long-term endangered species coverage for our normal and some subset of our possible future operations. And that's what we've done. And it's highly successful. We implemented in 2005. It took nearly 10 years to put that agreement That set of agreements, including all the compliance for the environment with regard to NEPA in place. But it's operating, it's essentially a habitat building program and habitat maintenance program, as well as we're stocking endangered fish and doing other research throughout. And that's what we're showing in those pictures, the planting of habitat in the bottom and one of our endangered species that we're repatriating in the top. Cost shared 50-50 by you all, the users of water and power, and the other 50% by the federal government. A unique program. We get Section 10 and Section 7 coverage for 50 years under that program. A major step. Okay, the drought continued. Keep in mind the downward spiral of the lakes, and so in 2004, we started to really look seriously about, well, we have surplus guidelines, we have water transfers going on for California, and they're at 4-4, what's next, and of course shortage in the lower basin we had to tackle. And so we put through in place these interim guidelines in December 2007. They started operating in 2008. So note again the word interim. So now the interim period went out to 2026. Well, we had a little mismatch with surplus. We folded surplus into this and dropped some of the more liberal provisions of that, of those guidelines. And so what our goal here was to get that full range of operations specified between these two lakes for the next 17 years, I think it ended up being, but through 2026. It also included strategies for shortage in the lower basin. We all knew very clearly from the Supreme Court that the Secretary could determine when surplus and shortage conditions exist in the lower basin, but there really wasn't guidance on how to do that. And we appreciate when courts just give us the framework without the specific guidance, perhaps, because then we could figure that out ourselves. And we did it collaboratively again and came up with this this set of operational guidelines. The key also is we had this new concept called intentionally created surplus. It is essentially a banking concept in Lake Mead. And what is allowed is that if you, as a user, have been using water and you're willing to conserve some of that water, you can leave it in Lake Mead now for a period of time. Prior to that, you really had to take it in each year. But now you could proactively conserve water and still keep some of that water for future use. There is a, what I commonly probably shouldn't, but I use the term system tax. If you leave the water in Mead, you get 5% off the top reduction on what you can take back out to help the system. Makes good sense. You also pay evaporative losses at about 3% a year, at least down to till we go to shortage. So an innovative program, again, a collaborative solution. There is no way this solution could have been put in place had entities in California, Arizona, and Nevada gotten together and figured this out and come up with some ideas on how to make it work, as well as us, the feds. So it worked out quite well. All right, moving forward in time. Again, this one's still in play till 2026. I'll skip that operational diagram. That just shows Mead and Powell in a little too much detail. Let's go to roll it forward to 2012. So all along this time, we knew Mexico would continue to be an issue. They get an apportionment or an allotment of 1.5 million acre feet, no questions asked, with regard from the treaty's perspective. However, there was a provision in the treaty that said under extraordinary drought, they would be required to take less. But there, again, no definition of extraordinary drought, and that's a pretty thorny one to try to take on what that means. And so what we tried to do again was extend the proactive collaborative approach across the border. And we came up with a solution, and it took 5+ years from the time we started it. We had envisioned it in the late 90s, if not earlier, but by the time we got it done and signed it, and it's an interim period, a pilot for 5 years. So one of the problems with interim measures is as you move forward, they start to get out of sync in the time frame. And so this one is a bit, but it's a very proactive, positive step. in terms of overall basin management. Probably the key thing to put in mind here is there was a fundamental tenet that we came up with. If one country's in shortage, both are in shortage. And if one country's in surplus, both are in surplus. And that, in some sense, was the breakthrough. That and the fact that we were willing to invest money in helping them build infrastructure to conserve water. And so that's the other key piece here. And we're very hopeful it'll turn out well, and we'll be set up for the next longer-term agreement with Mexico here prior to the expiration in 2017. And then we'll conclude this little snapshot of history with our basin study. And I'm not going to talk much about this, but again, by about 2012, it was really clear in the late 2000s that we needed to look longer term. We did get the federal legislation Jim talked about that made it very clear we should do this. That legislation was pinned over on the Hill a lot by our commissioner at the time, Connor, who's now our deputy secretary. So we had a really good insider there that understood what needed to be done. And so in any event, what we see long term, of course, is this supply imbalance in water supply and water demand. And I'm going to leave that to our folks to and yours, the teams, to talk about this as we move forward. All right. There I go again. Heavy thumb. So let me take you back. So there's the 15 years. It was a lot of progress. That's a lot of work. We did it together. Again, it would not have been accomplished without that approach. And I think one of the keys is a foundation of relationships. The reason we can tackle these very difficult, very complex problems is because of relationships on this basin. And I'll come back to that a little bit. But it is those relationships that give us the foundation to seek these kind of collaborative decisions, and we have to continue to make sure we have those. All right. Well, let me ask this question. So where do we go from here? We're up to current time. We're about half full system-wide, and the drought appears to persist. So what are we going to do? There we go. So let me start with this little picture, teacup diagram blown up of Lake Mead. And so there are feet on the left side, just elevations if you're tuned to those. There's amount of water and storage going down the right side. And I want to just point out a couple things. At the top of the reservoir, as you see, there are these surplus conditions that we mentioned. And then starting at 1075 is the first shortage condition. And then I want to just throw out a couple things. Look at 1050, there's a minimum power pool line. The good news at Lake Mead Hoover Dam is we can take the water through the turbines all the way down to what's called dead pool, right? Lake Powell actually isn't designed exactly that way. But for us it is. So what that meant was our current turbine designs would not operate well below 1050. We're already replacing those, which are termed wide head turbines. And we have three replaced, another two set up to be replaced. And so the power contractors pay for all this. They're proactively doing that. And we'll be able to continue power production at Hoover Dam. Now, it's not as efficient, of course, because we don't have as much pressure or head pushing the water, but they still operate quite well. The other thing I'll point out is the lower Southern Nevada intake, and John sitting in the back there is going to talk to you about that, so I won't mention that. One last thing. Teacup is drawn this way because the reservoir is basically shaped that way. So as you go down in elevation, there's less and less water. I think we're all very aware of that, but we have to really pay attention to it. So as we get lower and lower, our risks go up to not drain a reservoir. From our federal perspective, we don't want to operate these reservoirs low, real low. You don't have a buffer. It's not a good way to operate a big system like this. And so again, we're grappling with that in our drought contingency efforts. And I'm going to skip this idea of risk. Risk is simply that. It's what's the chance of the thing happening and what's the consequence if it happens? Multiply them together and you got a quantification of risk. I think everybody follows that and knows that. So what we always try to do is look a lot at the chances. What's the chance of something happening? So let me just roll back the clock again. And when we were doing the interim guidelines, here was a view of our chances of really low reservoirs. This is Lake Powell and Lake Mead. So this is the chance, the top line again, hard to see, is shortage. Let's avoid shortage right now. We know shortage will occur at 1075. Everyone's agreed to it. All of our efforts are over and above what Arizona and Nevada have already signed up for in terms of taking shortages. So let's look at the bottom two. So what those are is Powell going below its minimum power pool, 3490. And if it does, water can't go to the turbines. This is a hard design issue. This isn't a replace the turbine design. This is the pipes don't get water. So 3490 is a hard stop on Powell's power. Not something we'd want to do. And then we drew Mead 1000 because at the time that was a good indicator, not just because of Southern Nevada's lower intake, but a good indicator that you're in a risky situation. Because if we're at 1000, we have less than 5 million acre feet. It's about 4.3, 4.5 million acre feet in storage out of a 25 million acre foot reservoir. That's a very low condition and a risky place to be. That's what we thought. It was negligible. Those two lines bouncing around the zero line told us that the risks through 2026, the chance of it happening, were negligible. Roll it forward. I'm sure I could have hit the button here. All right. There we go. I'm just impatient. Okay, so let's roll it forward to today. So what we've shown here is the blue is what we thought the risk of going below 1,000, excuse me, at Lake Mead it was in 2008. That's the low blue line bouncing around zero. If you look at the red line, where we are on January 1st, 2015, from our current projections, that's the risk. That's quite a more substantive risk, a risk we have to deal with, upwards of 10% through this interim period. And then if we don't just look at historical records to help us project the future, if we look at climate change models, that's the green line. So the climate change models show us that the chance is even higher of going there. All right, so what are we doing about it? Well, it's a work in progress, and so there's the fundamental concepts are this. We first of all want to try to ensure the continued operation of these interim guidelines through 2026. Why? Because it'll take us years again. If we have to reopen and start over, we're going to not have a good, operating scheme in place for years. That's not a wise idea, I think, in terms of when you're in the middle of a drought. We also want to make sure we reduce that risk that I just showed you of reaching these critical reservoir elevations. That's the approach both basins are taking. So it is a basin-wide effort, but we did, as usual, the upper and lower basins typically go off because the systems operate quite a bit differently. The role of the secretary is quite a bit different between the two basins. They are now working separately in communication. We'll have to bring the two plans back together. But let me just quickly hit on some highlights. First of all, from the basin-wide perspective, just last week, I think it was, just 10 or so days ago, we announced what's been termed the System Conservation Program or System Conservation Agreement. And this is a pilot, very proactive agreement where there's $11 million, $2 million each has been put up by Denver Water, Southern Nevada Water Authority, Metropolitan Water District, and the Central Arizona Water Conservation District. $2 million each plus $3 million from us, the federal government. And that's, we'll go out with looking for willing folks with water who want to engage in conservation, get paid to do that, and that water will be left in the lakes as, quote, system water. not with anyone's name on it. It's a concept of generating water for the benefit of all of us and the system as a whole. So it's a pilot again. We're very excited about it. We'll roll it out first in the lower basin, upper basin, probably a year after that or so. We're not exactly sure. That's primarily, again, due to the different role the secretary has between the two basins. Lots more state engineers to get around how to manage that program with the Upper Colorado River Commission's help. So that's very exciting to us. Again, $11 million isn't much in terms of getting real water into the lakes, but it's a start. It's a start and a step in the right direction. So then in the upper basin also, just for them, their critical elevation they've defined is that 3490 power production at Lake Powell. There is still not a real high chance, I didn't show you that chance, but it's a pretty low chance of getting there, looking again at historical hydrology. However, the chance is finite, and they're looking at really a three-pronged effort. One is extending, enhancing their water weather modification programs, which they've had going on for a number of years. They're looking at extending the operation of those upper basin reservoirs. If you remember, we showed Fontenelle's full right now, and Fleming Gorge is, I forget, 88% full or whatever. The idea of meaning that you extend the current operation within their environmental compliance and move water temporarily from those reservoirs down to Powell to keep Powell above the power pool. Again, as an emergency type of effort, more or less. And finally, looking more long-term at what opportunities there may be for demand management. Again, something like system conservation ideas that we just talked about. In the lower basin, we've looked and defined a critical elevation as elevation 1020, 1020. So a bit above the 1,000 mark we talked about. What we are looking at is to allow, try to reduce the risk again of getting to that level, so that helps us avoid the risk of a rapid decline, given the fact that there's so much less water in the lake at that point. We're looking at a five-year pilot comprised of proactive and voluntary measures, and that's a key piece, voluntary. We're trying to, again, through our collaborative type approach, find things everyone can agree to do, and then ask us, the feds, the secretary, to abide by those agreements. That's a quicker way to do it, and it's, in my opinion, a much better way to do it. Again, because we'll get good solutions that can be implementable and make sense. The way we're looking at it is we want to put 1.5 to 3 million acre feet of water in Lake Mead over a five-year period. So through 2019, five-year agreement, let's try to put 1.5 to 3 million acre feet of water in Mead. It's phased, so we're looking at the first 3 years of trying to determine what volumes we can really all sign up for and agreed we're going to do, and with the idea that the last couple years would come on as needed. There'll be triggers, of course, if Mead's continuing its decline and the hydrology hasn't turned around, then there'd be a trigger to come back and do more, at least discuss what more we need to do. And so again, that kind of balances that idea of you don't want to wait too long, but you also don't want to take a whole bunch of costly measures that you might regret, right? So most of these measures, though, are of the non-regret type. They're proactive, again, and things that folks feel that they can do. I think just to quickly tell you what we're looking at in terms of doing those volumes is new ICS partnerships. We talked about the whole idea of ICS just briefly. Certainly, voluntary demand reductions are being discussed. Using alternative water supplies, local or from wherever, and reduce system losses. And the reduced system losses really falls on us. If you remember the mass balance slide of Lake Mead, And you remember that we had 9 million acre feet we need to deliver in a normal situation, 7.5 million to the three states plus 1.5 to Mexico. And I showed on that balance slide we can have up to 600,000 in losses. So that's a real opportunity there to try to crunch some of that down. It's, again, sounds easy. It's always harder than it perhaps should be. So that's a snapshot of what we're doing. Again, a work in progress. We're very excited. We are very hopeful. And I guess I would just conclude with this. Look, there's just difficult issues ahead. Drought does that to you. But even without the drought, there's difficult issues ahead for us. I pointed out to you, in the midterm, this Edelman guidelines end in 2026. We agreed in those guidelines that no later than December 31st, 2020, we'd get together and figure out, start the work on what to do post-2026. There's going to be some really thorny issues to deal with. The whole issue of compact calls for the upper basin, certainly this imbalance that we have at Lake Mead when we're absent high flow years. These are real tough issues that we'll have to grapple with. And long term, Carly and her team, and as well as all of you that are participating with us in our next steps of our basin study, the longer term demand imbalance of supply and demand is a huge issue. And it's an issue that I think we have to deal with, and we all know that. So, in conclusion, I just would just reiterate, collaborative solutions are absolutely the best. There's absolutely no question about that. And strong relationships are key. That's the foundation to finding collaborative decisions. I am very sure of that. And if you look around the room, and I say this because I'm one now, many of us are a little gray and losing or missing some hair, and it's not just stress, it's age. And so also look around the room and you see all the young faces here. And those young faces are the future. That's the legacy. So we have to build those relationships and nurture the ones we have, but build the new ones, because a bunch of us won't be here when all these things are really grappled with. And thank you for your attention. I'd be glad if we have time to take a question.
We do have some time, and about 5 minutes. Let me ask the first question, Terry.
Yes.
This is my understanding. Is it correct? If the calendar year ends with the elevation at Lake Mead at 1075 or less, Nevada and Arizona the following year cumulatively suffer a loss of 333,000 acre feet. Is that right?
You have got the volume right and you've got the concept right. And let me just fine tune it a little bit. We don't wait until December 31st at midnight to see where the lakes are, because it doesn't give people much planning time. We, in August, project where those lakes will be. And by August, we have good information because the snowpack's off and we know what has happened. And we project them. So it's the projection in August of that elevation that drives that decision. But other than that, you're spot on.
Questions? There you are.
Well, certainly the risk is higher, and I'll look over to Ken, Carly, Allen, if anybody knows how much higher. But we've got the data, but I don't recall. It's not low 1 to 2 up to 30-40, but it's probably more like 8 to 10. But we could get the exact numbers for you here, maybe before we even leave. Yeah.
All right, I'll ask one more.
Yep.
I think I was looking at the Bureau's website, and this is several months ago, and I think I saw in there that the Bureau had done a preliminary study of a diversion of 600,000 acre feet from somewhere on the Missouri River to the Denver metropolitan area. Is that kind of a one-time only deal that some elected official wanted you to do, or does it represent that the Bureau is looking at some of these intrabasin transfers as a way to solve some of the West's problems?
So do you remember Hogan's Heroes and Sergeant Schultz? I know nothing. No, honestly, Jim, I'm not absolutely familiar with that. Certainly, I think our basin study team is going to talk about some of the ideas that are being considered in that realm, and they might have a better feel for that.
Okay, anything else? Well, thank you, Terry, very much. Okay. So glad to have you back.
Thank you.